You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, June 6th, 2022.
Yeah.
What? June 7th. 2022. My name is Sam Seder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matt Ford, writer with the New Republic. Previewing, the Supreme Court cases soon to be decided, and perhaps changing your lives in some small or major, major way. Also on the program today, Akilah Lacey, politics reporter at The Intercept, on the attempt to thwart district attorney reform movement that's happening across the country. Meanwhile, it's primary day in California, New Jersey, Mississippi, Iowa, South Dakota, New Mexico, and Montana. In Texas, Jessica Cisneros calls for a recount. It's going to be a tough recount. Meanwhile, Fetterman off the campaign trail in Pennsylvania until July. New York passes a law prohibiting people from under the age of 21 from buying semi-automatics. Meanwhile, negotiations continue in the U.S. Senate. Don't hold your breath. Five Proud Boys indicted for seditious conspiracy. And on the eve of the primetime January 6th hearings, the committee reveals fake Trump electors in Georgia are told to keep their plan hush-hush because democracy. Federal judge throws out Louisiana redistricting, calls for one more black majority district. Boris Johnson survives his no-confidence vote. And the latest Starbucks to unionize in Astoria, Queens. Meanwhile, Townsend, Maryland Apple Store will vote in 8 days, the first of maybe many Apple stores across the country to attempt to unionize. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. It is Tuesday, and with me today, as she is always, Emma Vigeland.
Hello.
Hello, Emma. Tuesday.
Newsday Tuesday.
Newsday,
right?
Tuesday. Yeah. Okay. We're doing it.
Yeah.
There you go. Wanted to get into the Supreme Court rulings that we're going to hear in the next, it has to be probably in the next 3 weeks. We will find out about that. Meanwhile, New York passes one of the, begins to pass a suite of laws restricting gun ownership. There is a case in front of the Supreme Court as we speak that will be decided within days. New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruen, which may make it a lot more dangerous to be in New York, frankly, in terms of conceal and carry. There'll be a lot more good guys with guns. You just won't know who they are until they fire.
It'll be like a lightsaber thing, right? You'll know if it's a bad guy, if it's a red lightsaber or a red gun.
If the muzzle flash is red, they're a bad guy. If it's green, they're a good guy.
Yeah. Yes. And apparently the good guy guns, the bullets just drop off you. They don't even penetrate. Meanwhile, in the Senate, the U.S. Senate, there is, I don't know what to call this. Some dance around some type of gun control measures. And John Cornyn, the guy who's going to bring it all home, appointed by Mitch McConnell to be in the room for the talks. And, of course, what you realize is that John Cornyn is not there to facilitate the talks. John Cornyn is there to make sure that the talks go nowhere and do nothing. Here is Exhibit A of the guy brought in. And I'll tell you this. Anybody in the media who claims that John Cornyn is the guy who's going to do this is just lying to you. I don't know for a fact that anyone said that, but I can guess. There's a couple of people who I'm sure have hailed him as the deal maker.
But even like the congressional coverage, like Carl Hoss in the New York Times, it's still like he's the one coming to the table. Like,
yeah,
what
sure.
is he? What is he going to be able to get done? It's like that's presuming he wants to get anything
yes,
done.
Yes, he's the one coming to the table to prevent anything to get done. And here he is promoting his solution to gun violence.
This shooter should never have been able to gain access to Robb Elementary School that day.
Again, pause it for 1 second. You know, there's like a, there's just a millisecond where you're like, oh, the shooter should never have been able to gain access.
What?
To that type of weapon that could kill so many people. That's yeah. For 1 millisecond, you think like, wait a second, is this guy.
Total head fake.
Is he onto something? Well, now.
He's saying, like, what he's saying is there should be shooters, but they should just not be allowed to get into the elementary school. Like, if they can get into, like, a gas station or something like that, that's fine. But
right.
Yeah.
Right. This guy should have gone to the mall.
Well, that day. Again, the circumstances of how he gained that access are still under investigation. Initial reports indicated the door had been propped open. Now the police say the door had been closed, but it did not automatically lock like it was supposed to. If our schools need more resources to harden their infrastructure and to evaluate their physical security measures and make necessary improvements, that's something we can agree on and something we need to do. No one should be able to walk through the door of a school and access a classroom so easily. You can't get into an airport very easily. We know how to do this. Improving school safety also means.
Deal. If you want to improve school infrastructure and you want to make sure that schools have facilities that are a bit more up to date, then we can do that. We can reopen infrastructure talks and we'll add gun control measures to it.
What's the average size of an airport's police force? I mean, relative to, I mean, how many or, you know, security? I mean, is this some type of joke? Does anyone actually, like, is there any, and this is rhetorical because I know that nearly half the country hears this and goes, that makes sense. And I put on that dumb voice because that's a dumb reply. I don't know what else to tell you. There's no way you can make these places secure. And then is it okay if it's at a mall? Well, we can make we're going to spend all our money at schools on security.
Yeah, you'll have to take off your shoes before you enter a mall in America.
Malls are airports now, too, even though there's barely stores in them.
Everywhere's airports.
So, I mean, just as a matter of physics, which is easier? To secure all of the schools in all of the country with the multiple members of the school police force for each school. Make sure that we have absolutely no defective doors across the country at all time. You have a whole inspection team, too, on that doors. And then, of course, these people have to be trained and significantly braver than the cops in Uvalde who look like they were ready to get on assault vehicles and essentially, you know, conquer. I mean, they look like a paramilitary. So we need these, just to be clear, these security officers, multiple ones, of course, in these, in all of the schools across the country. We have 1.5 million kids going to schools just in New York City. Schools all across the country, they've got to be buffed up. They've got to have regular training. We're going to want to do that every 6 months, probably run them through their paramilitary training so that they can stop that one guy. Or you could simply say, no semi-automatic weapons. Anybody comes in there, they're not going to have the ability to scare a police force that constitutes 40% of the operating budget of a city.
Well, Cornyn reportedly, according to the New York Times, has already shot down the assault weapons ban that was being reinstated. So that's already a non-starter for him. Like, he's just the less detestable senator from Texas that is the senator from the state where this massacre happened that McConnell shoehorned into these negotiations to just, like, do, I don't know, what is it, play acting, some sort of theater. They're running out the clock. He doesn't actually even believe this stuff about, you know, fortifying school safety, making schools like airports or like prisons, either way, because there's no bill or, like, actual proposal that he's trying to put forward as of now, at the very least. This is just a way to hide the ball and run out the clock so they don't have to do anything. And he's the human who's been tasked with that.
If you search Cornyn gun control, just from Politico to articles, GOP senator surprisingly bullish on prospects for a bipartisan gun deal. And then another one, the Texas conservative turned Biden approved rational Republican on guns. So yeah.
Oh my God. BB Teach on the IM has a good analogy here. I'm going to change it just slightly. You got two choices. You could cover the entire planet in felt, or people could wear shoes. That's the choice you have. All right. Got a couple of sponsors here, and then we will get to Matt Ford, who is going to give us a highlight, low light, a preview of some of the Supreme Court cases that are coming our way just within, could be days. Could be a couple of weeks. Let's start with this. So many things to do over the course of the summer. People are excited to get out. You want to free up as much time as possible. So if you're a business owner, the last thing you want to do is sort through tons of candidate resumes that may or may not fit with your job. Instead, you could be enjoying pool time or going out to the park or running through a sprinkler. I still do that. It's because my kids gardening, plant some trees. That's why you need ZipRecruiter. It is the best way to find great candidates for your job. They do the work for you. And now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. I have used this service. It's how we found Brendan. It was incredibly easy to use. It was incredibly organized. I got a ton of great candidates. And ZipRecruiter actually went out and grabbed Brendan, they didn't physically grab him, but encouraged him to apply. And he was literally the perfect candidate. It was like he had been like germinated in a Petri dish. And that's how we got Bradley, through Brendan. So ZipRecruiter has provided us, as far as I'm concerned, with 2 top employees. So soak it all up that summer has to offer and let ZipRecruiter do the work. Are you ready for the URL? It's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's where you can try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, MAJORITY. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. Also, this is really a helpful service. I've talked about ExpressVPN many times. Your phone carrier collects data on whatever you're doing. They say it so they can better understand your interests. Which is a sort of a doublespeak for this is a way we can sell your data to advertisers and, frankly, to hedge funders. The phones are tracking you. It's just the fact.
It's true.
It is time to start using ExpressVPN. Now, what ExpressVPN does, it's an app that prevents your phone carrier from being able to see the sites you visit. With one tap of a button, all your network data gets encrypted and rerouted through ExpressVPN secure servers. Not only does it shield your web browsing, ExpressVPN protects all of your network data so you can stay private even when you're using your favorite apps. They track you on the apps, folks. We don't do it with the Majority Report app, but all the other apps do. And they sell that data. And then, you know, they sell it to hedge funders. You're like, this is where we should be putting this coffee store because this is where this person likes to get coffee. I mean, it's like that. Mm. ExpressVPN works on all your devices, iPhone, Android, tablet. One subscription can be used on up to five devices at the same time. Let me tell you something. If you are in any way intimidated by the use of this, I'll tell you, it is the easiest thing in the world to use. You download the app, you hit one button. It will say New York in my case, but if I want to switch it to California or I want to switch it to a foreign country, boom, and I go through that server. It's super easy. I am on my phone, well, I don't want to say constantly, but a lot. And I do all sorts of, it's my job. And the ability to just one press of a button and make sure that what I'm doing is secure is priceless. When your phone carrier tracks you, that's a gross invasion of privacy. You can either keep letting them cash in on you or visit expressvpn.com/majority to get the same VPN I use. Take back your online privacy today. Use my link to get 3 extra months free. That's expressvpn, expressvpn.com/majority. expressvpn.com/majority. And lastly, we used to sell some other sheets on this show that I quite like. We had to end that relationship because we didn't like their business practices. We've been looking around for different sheets that we could promote and found them. Cozy Earth provides the softest, most luxurious, and best temperature, the best temperature regulating sheets that there are. That for me is, I don't mind, you know, the softness, okay, I like that, but I can't feel anything anyways. Luxury, it is temperature regulating, which is important to me because I sleep hot. Cozy Earth has been featured on Oprah's Most Favorite List Things 4 years in a row, made from super soft viscose from bamboo. I don't know, viscose? I don't know what.
Viscous?
Viscous? I don't know. But it's from bamboo. Cozy Earth sheets breathe so you can sleep at night in the perfect temperature. In the perfect temperature all year round. It has thousands of five-star reviews. It is no wonder the Cozy Earth sheets have become the bedding of choice for interior designers and celebrities like us. Cozy Earth even offers a 100-night sleep trial. You have 100 nights to sleep on it. You can wash it. You try it out. If you're not completely in love with them, you send them back for a full refund. How's that for no risk? There's a 10-year warranty. Cozy Earth sheets come in 4 new colors. Check it out. Really, honestly, if you sleep hot or cool or cold, I guess, these will do you right. Best temperature regulating sheets I've ever had. And for a limited time, you can save 35% on Cozy Earth bedding. Go to cozyearth.com/majority. Enter my special promo code majority at checkout to save 35% now. That's cozyearth.com/majority. And be sure to enter majority at checkout for 35% off. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. What's that? Yeah, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will have Matt Ford. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, writer for the New Republic, Matt Ford. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Give me a sense. You've been writing about the Supreme Court for quite a while. Give me a sense of how consequential, in terms of, I don't know, by any metric you want to use, the decisions that we're about to hear over the next, well, it could be, I don't know, 3 weeks, less?
Mm-hmm.
Give us a sense. How consequential are these decisions?
It could be very consequential, or it could be very, very consequential. And I think some of that rests in the hands of the justices, how they reside these specific cases. But basically, no matter which way they turn on a lot of these issues, they will be setting some serious precedents. On issues that range, obviously, from abortion, everybody knows that by this point, but also on gun rights, on tribal sovereignty, on the First Amendment and religious freedom in public schools, on a whole host of issues. They're poised to make some groundbreaking rulings here.
You wrote a piece about the way that they're announcing their decisions. And just give us a sense of generally how that happens, what your theory is as to why we haven't had more decisions announced at this point.
Sure. Well, I think that what we're seeing behind the scenes is some of the friction that we know is taking place among the justices. We're seeing it sort of play out in how these decisions are coming about. Now, right now, as of today, we have about 30 decided cases left to be handed down by the end of the term. By that, I mean cases that went through oral argument. And of those, of course, there's a lot of big ones, but there's also a lot of smaller ones that deal with, you know, railroad pensions and things like that, that don't necessarily affect a lot of Americans. Usually they're able to get these out on a pretty even basis over the weeks leading up to this month. But we've seen a backlog of sorts. And I think that part of the reason, obviously we don't know with exact precision why that's going on, but there's plenty of reason to believe that some of this discord behind the scenes at the court may have been playing a role in that, that the justices are having a harder time coming to sort of cohesive rulings on some of these cases, and that is affecting their ability to bring them out on a regular basis.
I have a sense of what you mean by friction, but I mean, how much do we really know? Like, I mean, how much do we know in terms of like who the friction is between where we're at on the investigation about the leak? Because I think that's, you know, seems to me to be... they're going to come up with if they come up with who the leaker was, they're going to drop it at a very, you know, I don't know, like the third week of August, I feel like, or the fourth week of August, when, you know, there's all the Supreme Court reporters are on vacation and no one's, you know, I get the sense they're going to want to be quiet about that. But do we have a real sense of what the friction is? Because it seems to me that is contingent upon who leaked it. Right?
Right.
I mean, if it's one of the liberal justices clerk, someone's going to be bad. But if it's one of the conservative justices clerk, I would imagine John Roberts is going to be very, very angry at that person.
I think I'll start by saying that all the justices will not be happy with whatever clerk did that. And I think that goes for liberals and conservatives alike. They really prize their ability to hold these sorts of discussions behind closed doors. And I think that for them is an institutional concern that supersedes the sort of partisan rancor. They don't want to work for a place for the rest of their lives where they have to worry about this sort of thing. But beyond that, I think to your question more specifically, we know this, you know, sort of through a little bit of Kremlinology. We've had public remarks recently by Justices Alito and Justices Thomas, where they say that either through omission or directly that this court isn't as well functioning and as, you know, collegial as it used to be. Alito, you know, when he was asked about the leak the other day, he obviously declined to speak about it in general terms. But, you know, he refused to say whether the justices could even sort of get a friendly lunch together. And when you look at the justices' past remarks in these sort of law school events, they usually say, you know, at the end of the day, we're all friends and, you know, we were able to put that behind us. So his omission there was telling. You also have Thomas saying that, you know, this is the most this isn't the court that he started out on, the Rehnquist Court, which from roughly for him 1990 to 2005. He portrayed that as a very collegial, friendly court that he could trust, that he could get along with. The implication being that the current court headed by John Roberts is not that. So I think that while, you know, obviously the leaker could have been any of the clerks, they're certainly assuming that it was a liberal clerk, and they're assuming that, you know, this is part of what they see as a liberal left attack on the courts in general.
They're trying to project, at the very least, that they're assuming that it's a liberal clerk.
Right. I think that, you know, for them, their logical conclusion is that the only reason you would have leaked this is to sort of embarrass the right to gin up opposition to that. And, you know, a liberal clerk may well have thought that. There is also a strong sense that it could have been a conservative clerk trying to, you know, pin them down.
Well, we do know there were prior, I mean, leaks, I guess, as to what was going on, right? There was a couple to the Wall Street Journal, and that was not by a liberal clerk. I mean, they specifically, the Journal ID'd this person as someone who was close to the conservative justices. That would not have been a liberal clerk.
Right. And I think we can assume in general that a liberal clerk is not chatting it up with the members of the Wall Street Journal editorial board.
Correct.
I think they have gotten leaks before, both in this recent case and in Bostock, which was the LGBT workplace discrimination case recently, that suggested, you know, that the conservatives were sort of betraying the conservative legal movement.
So would a clerk speak to a reporter without permission, without the knowledge of the judge that they're working for?
I have a hard time imagining that any justice would sanction a clerk leaking something to the press. Mainly because I assume that if they actually for some reason felt that strongly, they would simply do it themselves. I do think that, you know, for the court, this is a court that sees itself not as part of the rest of the Washington political establishment. You know, obviously there are a lot of people who disagree with that, but they see themselves as sort of apart. And the idea for them that they could be part of the leaks and spin dynamic that they see in Congress, that they see in the White House, that's something that I think that they're uniformly against. And if a clerk did this, they probably did it thinking that they would have some sort of impact on the court's decisions beyond what a justice could accomplish.
All right. So let's, with that said, let's go through some of these cases that are going to be pretty serious. I mean, I think obviously Dobbs v. Jackson's women's health. I think everyone is familiar with the implications of this. Certainly, if they've, you know, listened to this show, they should. And that would be, there is a potential, if that brief that was leaked is the brief, Roe v. Wade is done, period. I mean, frankly, in the event that they find for, I guess, Dobbs, you know, if the 15-week minimum, if the 15-week ban stands in and of itself, it is de facto, regardless of what the court says, a reversal of Roe v. Wade, because Roe v. Wade had a specific, particularly with Casey, had a specific window in which you could not ban abortion. Right. I mean, so and I think we know the implications of that. Could it get any could they go any further? I mean, they're not going to go any further than what we saw in the Alito thing. But the Alito thing opens up the door for Obergefell and maybe Griswold, which is birth control and marriage equality.
Right. There are two answers to that question. And one is specific to abortion. Now, I think a lot of people think that overturning Roe v. Wade would be sort of the logical endpoint of the anti-abortion movement, that once they return it to the states, it would then be something that they pursue on a democratic means. Something that Alito alludes to throughout his opinion, but doesn't really, you know, very consciously doesn't get too in the weeds on, is whether or not a fetus is a person under the 14th Amendment, and whether or not they have legal personhood. And this is something pushed by one wing of the anti-abortion movement. It's not something that has unanimous agreement on them as a viable legal strategy. But it is something that they have suggested, that if they do adopt that and if they get the Supreme Court to endorse it, it would make abortion illegal nationwide, because it would then be equivalent to homicide. That's sort of one approach they're taking. More specifically, and more to your question about the rest of these cases on Griswold, on Obergefell. Well, you know, Alito tried, whether genuinely or not genuinely, to sort of put some daylight between what he would rule in Dobbs and what the court might do in those cases. And I think that the degree to which you think he succeeded depends on the degree to which you think he is being honest there. If you think that Samuel Alito would actually vote to sustain Griswold or Obergefell, then sure, you can take him at his word on that. But I think that if you look at the logic he uses to reach this decision, where he says that rights that are not, you know, clearly rooted in the Anglo-American legal tradition don't have any constitutional validity, I think that, you know, it's hard to escape the logic of that, you know, sodomy laws, which had a long history in the American and English legal system, would not be able to come back. Same-sex marriage bans would be justified. Bans on contraception could come back. I think that the problem for this court is going to be trying to convince people that they have a limiting principle here.
Right.
When they're, it's very hard for them to logically add one.
Yeah, let me give you an indication of how much honesty I think that we're getting from Alito. It's somewhere around here. But be that as it may, we will find out. And this is the thing that many people understand in terms of the implications of these cases. You can address a case and make it extremely narrow and tailored to that. But if you put within the reasoning of that case, You can write these things and say, but don't apply this to anything else. Like we saw with the 2000 Supreme Court case, Bush v. Gore, where like the court was adamant, do not rely on this case for any future case. They're sending this message to all the circuit courts and all the subsidiary courts in the country, which are all the other courts. And it simply has not been the case that case has not been cited. It's been cited multiple times. All right, let's go to New York State Rifle and Pistol versus Bruin. I'm not even sure who Bruin is in this. I imagine some New York State official or something. But this is for New York State. This is we're going to see, I think, gun laws and gun control. This is where we're going to see the most friction in this state. And tell us what this is.
So this is a case that challenges New York State's method for handing out concealed carry licenses. Under New York's scheme, it allows concealed carry licenses to exist, but it leaves discretion on the application and the consideration to local officials. I believe that Bruin is a sheriff in a county, although I can't recall from the top of my head which one. And he is charged with handing out these concealed carry licenses. Now, the plaintiffs here are two men who wanted concealed carry licenses for, you know, generalized fear of crime and for personal protection, and they were denied. And they have sued, arguing that this is a violation of their Second Amendment right to an individual right to bear arms. Now, what makes this case sort of unusual is that New York does have a sort of unusual system for handing out concealed carry licenses. It's far more discretionary for local officials than you see in a lot of other states. And it's far more sort of loosely applied in certain circumstances. There's a brief by some public defenders that argue that, you know, this is being used to unfairly criminalize their clients in ways that can be racially discriminatory. And I think we certainly know that the NYPD's Stop and Frisk program has some roots here. So this is a complex case. And that gives the justices a certain amount of latitude here. You know, they haven't taken a Second Amendment case in about 12 years. Not since the 2010 case, McDonald v. Chicago. So they could deliver a pretty narrow ruling here that says, look, the New York law in question, this is just too vague, too extraneous to a lot of factors. It doesn't give proper consideration, and you need to start over. And that would be one that could be just a narrow, tailored law to the New York situation. On the other hand, they could go further, and they could write some sweeping language here about the right to bear arms going into the concealed carry sphere, and that could imperil a whole broader range of limits. There are about 12 to 15 states that have laws that are more less restrictive than New York's, but still more restrictive than a lot of other states, states like California, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and that could open the door to changing their concealed carry laws here. And I think especially after the Uvalde shooting and the shootings before and since, there's a lot of renewed interest in what exactly they could do on an expansive level.
It's going to be interesting to see if John Roberts doesn't say, you know, hey, guys, we're going to overturn Roe v. Wade. Let's just take it easy. And we can punt this gun control issue by saying this specific gun control law has some flaws in it, as opposed to the whole concept of gun control laws needs to be chucked out the window. Let's talk about West Virginia versus EPA. This one could be, I mean, it seems to me that there has been an ongoing push by the conservatives on this court to dismantle the administrative state. We saw it in the ruling about OSHA not being able to dictate worker safety if it's a potential danger outside the workplace, which just seems ludicrous. We've seen it in the context of one or two other cases that escape me at the moment where they start to drop hints as to the non-delegation principle and the idea that the Chevron doctrine that and this one is another one of those, I guess, doctrines within that basket that ultimately it seems to be a march to really kneecap the administrative state. Tell us about that.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that they I'm glad you brought up the OSHA case, because I think that's a good segue into how the issues they're deciding here can apply more generally. In the OSHA case you mentioned, which was involving the vaccine mandate for employers, the court blocked it on the grounds that, Congress, when it gave OSHA these powers, hadn't spoken clearly enough. It used what's called the major questions doctrine. And this is something that's sort of a loose judicial invention from the last few decades. It has some roots before that, but generally over the last few decades, where the court has said that, look, if Congress wants to decide a major issue, it will speak clearly on that and give the appropriate agency the power to do so. And this is sort of designed to, in the abstract, this allows, the courts to say, well, just because Congress said X doesn't mean it meant to do X, Y, and Z. And there are some, understandable concerns there about overreach and whatnot. But more specifically to this, it's being used to pursue much more ideological goals and much more on part of some of the parties in some of these cases, I would say almost disingenuous goals, where the goal is not necessarily to properly restore the balance between the branches of government. It's to sort of limit the power, like you said, of the administrative state to decide that. And so what the court will do here is consider whether or not to say that the major questions doctrine limits the EPA's power to regulate carbon emissions, which I'm sure you can understand has major implications for a lot of the EPA's efforts to fight climate change.
And to be clear here, was the court saying in the OSHA case, just to get a sense of it, that had Congress specifically said that OSHA can consider people going into work with other people who have not mitigated their chances of getting a virus in a pandemic, then that would have stood? I mean, the second one in 100 years, you may be like catch on to that. But there's a whole host of things that Congress couldn't contemplate and certainly couldn't act upon to empower these agencies to do what would be obvious, right? I mean, it seems obvious to most people that if there's a pandemic, that going into work and being in high, sort of density areas with fellow workers, that if there was one way to mitigate the risk, in that you could mandate that mitigation. And, people can make an argument like, well, not every place that you work at has high density, but working out the details of that in the context of a pandemic and how you enforce that seems to be rather difficult. But in that instance, would it have stood if Congress was like absolutely explicit?
Well, I think it's hard to say, because then you might find people challenging on other grounds, whether or not that's permissible under the Commerce Clause, for example, for Congress to make that sort of sweeping judgment. But I think you identified the most specific problem here with the major questions doctrine, which is that Congress writes in broad terms. And it does so not necessarily out of laziness or out of, incipient authoritarianism, but because these are often complex things that it doesn't have the time or the ability to adjust on a case-by-case basis every year. Congress created the Occupational Health and Safety Administration to handle workplace, risks, to mitigate them, to create systems to help workers get protected from them. The court said, just because it didn't sort of have the specific authorization. When it does that, what they say is that the Congress in the 1970s should have anticipated a pandemic and should have passed laws more accordingly, which I'm sure would have been great if they had given that the Congress that warning in the 1970s. But they didn't. They gave OSHA a mandate to, you know, restrict the amount of, you know, workplace exposure to toxins and hazards and things like that, which I'm sure a lot of people agree that COVID is a hazard. And by sort of sidestepping that, they've really sort of elided the question without answering it on whether or not OSHA has the ability to do this. They've simply said, well, Congress didn't speak clearly enough, and therefore they can't do this. It's a way to limit the administrative state without explicitly going through the efforts of saying, well, you can't do this.
Well, all right, Matt, we really appreciate you giving us this preview. There's a couple other cases, Kennedy v. Brettman and Oklahoma v. Castro Huerta. Maybe when these things get decided, we'll have you on. We'll talk about those as well. We're going to be doing a lot, I have a feeling, on the Supreme Court. And hopefully for your sake, based upon the piece that you wrote, these decisions will be spread out a little bit so you have time to catch up with them.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Matt, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Akilah Lacey will be here. She's the politics reporter at The Intercept. Emma had to step out for a minute. She's not feeling that well. She's all good. And we'll be right back in a moment with Akilah. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. Joining us now is Akilah Lacey. She is the politics reporter for The Intercept and has been writing on the attempt to recall Chesa Boudin, who is the one of, I guess, maybe almost a half dozen, would you say, reform-minded, I guess, district attorneys across the country who has been elected over the past 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, so there, Chesa and Larry Krasner in Philadelphia are two who get a lot of attention these days. But going back to 2014, Kim Fox in Chicago Kim Gardner in St. Louis, Wesley Bell also in St. Louis, and then several other district attorneys in Northern Virginia and in California in recent years as well, many of whom have faced recall attempts and other, you know, sort of backlash to their attempts to implement criminal justice reforms.
All right. And we should say that this recall attempt against Kesa Boudin is happening right now, literally today in California. Yeah. So if you're watching this and you're in San Francisco and you contemplated not voting for whatever reason, good time to change your mind. And you can either listen to what has been going on in this recall attempt or just go right now and go vote. Give us a sense, I mean, of how this started. Well, and spoiler alert, the recall attempt started before he actually took office.
Yeah. So there's been several sort of different iterations of this in the last few years. So Kesa Boudin was elected in 2019. He took office in January 2020. In the time frame, you know, before he actually took office, somebody purchased the domain called recallchesa.org. You know, shortly before he took office, there were sort of discussions around launching, you know, a petition to have him resign, which eventually morphed into the first recall attempt that did not gather enough signatures to get on the ballot in the first attempt. This attempt, the second since he's been in office, he's only been in office for 2.5 years, did get enough signatures to get on the ballot. And so this, you know, is put to a vote today. But going back to his election and when he took office, even prior to his election, he was facing really tough criticism and attacks, much of which came from the San Francisco Police Department, which their union spent more than $500,000 to defeat his campaign in 2019. They ran attack ads against him from this past August until February of this year, and have been a major driver of the anti-Boudin, anti-criminal justice reform sentiment in San Francisco, even though they haven't, you know, officially taken a position on the recall this time around. But that is the groundwork, you know, that has gone into putting up this recall. Again, to your point, this has been a fight that Kesa has been fighting since before he even was elected or before he took office.
Who are the players that are pushing this? There's some big money behind this. And then we can talk about why. But I mean, I think and people can guess to a certain extent. But let's talk about the money that's involved in this, because it's coming from. Well, I mean, I guess maybe some of the people you would expect, but there's some people with some deep pockets here.
Yeah, so the recall campaign and its supporters, there's a couple of different iterations of groups: Neighbors for a Better San Francisco, Neighbors for a Better San Francisco Advocacy, like all of these groups that are sort of funding the main recall attempt. But they're getting support from this major Republican donor, William Oberndorf, who has been a longtime contributor to the Mitch McConnell-aligned Senate Majority PAC, which is, you know, dedicated to maintaining Republican power in the Senate. So that's one of the major donors here. Other folks are affiliated with some of like the corporate giants, like courier services and delivery food services in the Bay Area, who have been the subject of some, I guess, attempts to rein in their power or hold them accountable for, you know, violating workers' rights, which is something that Kesa has also taken, made a priority of his office. And then there are sort of the surrogates of the recall campaign who are in a lot of ways, you know, they're put forth as volunteers or, you know, everyday San Franciscans who, you know, got fed up with Kesa and decided to join the recall campaign. In reality, they're paid workers for the campaign, one of whom is the former chair of the San Francisco Democratic Party, Mary Jung, who is also a lobbyist for the local chapter of the Real Estate Realtors Association, which is another major supporter of the recall attempt, along with Shorenstein Realty, which is a major realtor in the area. So those are some of the big names. I'll pause there.
Yeah, I mean, so we've got, major Republican donors. We've got police officers' unions. We've got the angel investor, Jason Calacanis, as you say. And he set up a GoFundMe. Like, what was the theory behind? Well, I mean, on one level, I mean, this guy's obviously worth millions, at least. He sets up a GoFundMe to raise $60,000. It's really basically an attempt to make it look like I'm just some, concerned citizen, as opposed to I want to kneecap a guy who might be, maintaining city ordinances that might inhibit my ability to leverage those ordinances to make money. I don't know, like Uber or Lyft or something like that, or DoorDash or whatever it is. I mean, this is the thing that I think people miss, is that this is only partially from the police, sort of like, I guess, a quadrant of people don't want to have that type of accountability for the police department. But there's a whole host of people out there who rely on a district attorney who's not going to be anti-corporate. And when that person comes in, obviously they start talking about crime, but it's not about a crime at all. It's about, right. It's about, basically the unlawfulness of some of these business enterprises.
Right. So this GoFundMe thing is really strange because its purpose was to fund a publication, effectively to quote unquote hold Chezza accountable, which in its actual form is a Substack run by a freelance journalist named Susan Reynolds, who I would not describe the content on the Substack as journalism. I think it's a lot of commentary and opinion writing, most of which launders tough on crime talking points to blame Chezza Boudin for effectively anything that's happening in San Francisco. I interviewed Jason Calacanis when we wrote about this GoFundMe when Boudin first took office. He was concerned that we were writing a hit piece on him and didn't really seem to take any of the criticism as far as, why would you be fundraising to sort of undermine a democratically elected official when, you have all this money, you could easily go put this, if you're really concerned about X, Y, and Z, you could go and, contribute to a cause, or if you're concerned about homelessness, you could go fund shelters for people, or, that is sort of the underlying tone of a lot of the folks that are supporting the recall. There is so much money pouring into this right now. When you talk about the issues that people are really concerned about in San Francisco and that they bring up when you ask them, why they support the recall, they're talking about homelessness and drug overdoses and crimes of poverty and visible symptoms of a system that is failing people that they don't want to see. If we took all the money that's gone into this recall campaign, which is over, it's close to $1 billion at this point. Imagine what you could have done in San Francisco to alleviate some of these issues that people, on both sides of the recall do have concerns about, whether it's the lack of affordability or lack of affordable housing or lack of, substance abuse treatment services or wraparound services for folks in the Bay Area. It's really disheartening to think about how much could have been done with this money and what it's actually going to, which it'll be over tomorrow, right? It's all going to be over tomorrow. Yeah.
I think the fact that there was a, recall, Chezza, website 4 days before he took office is indicative of the sincerity of the concerns of some of these folks here. But give us a sense of, to the extent that people are complaining about rising crime, et cetera, what are the statistics? Like, objectively speaking, what are the statistics on that?
So I have them right here. So two things. Crime fell in 2020, which was in San Francisco, in Boudin's first year in office. It fell all over the place because of COVID for a lot of reasons and for other reasons that, scholars and people who study criminology still don't totally understand. At the same time, homicides did spike, as they spiked in cities across the country and rural areas across the country, indiscriminately of whether a Republican or a Democrat ran those areas or was a prosecutor in those areas. In 2021, last year, violent crime in San Francisco overall increased by 1%, which was driven by an uptick in 8 homicides. This number, a 32% increase in homicides, has been being thrown around. We're actually talking about a hard number of 8 homicides. And obviously, every homicide is a horrible tragedy, but I just want to put this in context. 32% sounds like a way bigger number than 8. Violent crime, which includes aggravated assault, rape, increased by 13% last year. At the same time, arrest rates for every crime that the police have tracked have decreased since Bowdoin has come into office. Clearance rates for every crime in each of the categories that I've just listed have decreased over the time that Bowdoin has been in office. And so the issue that we're looking at is people who see a prosecutor coming in saying he doesn't want to prosecute low-level drug offenses, he doesn't want to prosecute violent offenses, and making this connection that, okay, when I'm hearing about homicide spikes, when I'm seeing videos of shoplifting, when I'm seeing, you know, overdoses on the street, this is the person who's responsible. Instead of thinking, okay, well, not necessarily understanding the process that has to go into effect for him to be able to prosecute a crime, or thinking about what happens or what the logical endpoint of, you know, wanting to prosecute someone for an overdose death would mean. That could mean locking up a person who's running drugs for someone. That could mean locking up somebody who has a substance abuse issue and hasn't had housing for the past 10 years, and not really understanding that that doesn't solve the issue that they're most concerned about. And on the flip side of that, you don't necessarily have people who understand that the prosecutor can't take action unless the police actually arrest someone. The police in San Francisco despise Chesa Boudin. There is a conversation about them sort of going on strike during his tenure because they don't want to do their job because they think that he's not going to prosecute it. This has been an argument that we've seen. I covered this in Austin, Texas. Police there were telling locals that they weren't going to prosecute crimes or they weren't going to arrest people because the progressive DA there wasn't going to prosecute anything. That is not the police's determination to make. And so I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand that there's a breakdown happening at a very basic level when you're talking about are people being arrested for the crimes that you want them to be arrested for? Does that arrest actually lead to a solution for the problem that you're asking for? And are these people even coming under the district attorney's purview? And a lot of the cases that are thrown at Chesa, blaming him for X, Y, and Z, he hasn't actually had an opportunity to prosecute. Some cases he has. And so you can make the argument on those. That's a light picture of crime stats. Yeah.
And to be clear, I mean, you know, the reality probably is because the cops I guess there's been instances where the cops wouldn't show up to help him, like literally like confiscate some material recently. Yeah. I heard that he had to rent U-Hauls or something like that. The cops are not cooperating with him. They want to make him look bad. And this isn't because they're mad that he's not convicting or his conviction rate is low. They're mad because they're afraid that they can't get away with lying, with breaking the law by infringing upon the rights of different people there. I mean, we have an ongoing perfect example of what's going on in Uvalde, Texas, in terms of like the whimsical nature of cops lying, because they never get called on this stuff and they don't want it really. I mean, ultimately, from what my understanding is, if you want to change the behavior of cops, aside from the argument that we should take a lot of stuff off their plate and the funding that goes with it. But if you want to change the behavior of cops, it's only the district attorney who can do that because they hold them responsible and the cops don't want to be held responsible.
Yes. And Boudin is the first district attorney in the history of San Francisco prosecutors to bring homicide charges against a cop, which is not lost on the police, obviously. The police also put, they entered an agreement under George Gascon, Boudin's predecessor, who, as an aside, currently the district attorney in LA, also facing a recall attempt there, who they entered an agreement under Gascon's office that allowed the district attorney to prosecute cops for misconduct effectively. The police department pulled out of that agreement in February of this year, after having renewed it, you know, less than half a year before. And my read of that is that they saw the writing on the wall that there was going to be more momentum for the recall this time around because of this, you know, because of sort of national fear mongering around crime. And they decided, you know, we're going to make this statement, even though we just agreed to allow him to prosecute us for misconduct. We're going to pull out of this agreement, you know, sort of as a, you know, as a middle finger to him, and making a statement on their disdain for the position that he's taken against cops. Same thing with Larry Krasner in Philadelphia. Same with right. a lot of the other district attorneys that we listed. Not only have they implemented these criminal justice reforms that are widely popular inside San Francisco and across the country, not to mention, but they have also prioritized cases of police misconduct, prioritized reinvigorating wrongful conviction units, which make the police look bad. Because they're pointing out their mistakes, they're undoing their mistakes, and they're giving fodder to the people who are pushing for criminal justice reform and pushing for more ways to hold police accountable when they do this.
What's the status of the agreement between, let's say, Muggers and the district attorney's office as to whether they should be whether the DA is allowed to prosecute them for mugging? I mean, that's just absurd. Just the concept that the police negotiate with the district attorney's office to, like, yes, you may investigate us for misconduct. It's just absurd.
Yeah, and it just speaks to the amount of power that the police have, right? To your point, there are very few people who have the power to hold them accountable, and they know that. And, you know, police unions have been very active in these races for district attorneys all around the country. And it's been, I mean, they've been a major player in not only funding these attempts, but also drumming up, sort of anger and fear around them.
I wonder if I can get into negotiations, about parking tickets, and see if I can get, I pull out the negotiation that I can get parking tickets here. What is it that, Larry Krasner, we had the same sort of strum and drang in his before his I guess it was his primary. And he won his primary handily. The buildup was pretty intense in terms of, like, this guy's in jeopardy. And in fact, he won by, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it was super handily.
Yeah.
What's different? And who knows? Maybe Boudin wins this recall. Although we get the same sort of notion of, like, he is, that it doesn't look good for him. I think is, yeah, you know, the sort of the preponderance of the press. Let's assume for a moment that press is correct. Why was it successful in San Francisco but not in Philadelphia?
Mm-hmm. So I actually asked Boudin about this because, you know, it is by all the polls that are out there, it's going to be a tight contest. It's not going to be easy for him. I think in San Francisco, because of the national place that San Francisco has sort of occupied in the press, whether we're talking about, sort of national crime trends or, national, issues with the overdose crisis or housing affordability, San Francisco is sort of, upheld as an example or sort of a city where you can see the confluence of all of these things in one place very starkly, because of the massive economic inequality and the boom sort of in in young tech workers who are in the area and who have sort of contributed to this widening inequality in the city. So it's a place where it's very visible and easy to see. I think what also contributes to this is that people in the Bay Area, they're not expecting huge turnout in this race, which I think could work against Bowdoin. We saw, obviously, a statewide recall is not the same. We're talking about a city recall, but high turnout saved Gavin Newsom in his recall last year. People are not expecting there to be super high turnout for this election, which is understandable. It's an off year. It's an off cycle election. But I think in terms of the polling and the things that we're seeing in terms of coverage and polling of why this has been so successful, I think it speaks to sort of a lack of understanding of and also a lack of interrogation of some of the claims made by the recall by national media who have just sort of jumped on this story as an example of why the reform movement is headed for doom. Right. So you have sort of people jumping in and covering this story, talking about, unprecedented levels of crime in San Francisco when they actually aren't looking into the data and understanding sort of the nuances there or looking into, okay, well, what are the police doing? And so we have a rush to cover this as sort of the next bellwether in, the criminal justice reform law enforcement, war that's going on without people who really understanding what the difference is in San Francisco. And unfortunately, a lot of the people who consume that media, this sort of mainstream liberal media, live in San Francisco. Right. So it's creating a feedback loop. I won't sit here and say that there are people who are educated and understand all of this and still support support the recall. Like, people exist who understand this and have their own views of the situation. But I think in terms of looking at the success of this effort versus the success of the effort against Larry Krasner, we're talking about just a totally different sort of political and socioeconomic class of people and consuming a different set of media that has influenced a lot of the understanding of this.
And I imagine from a national perspective, this San Francisco has much more value just because of the way that San Francisco, rightly or wrongly, and I would argue wrongly, frankly, is perceived as, the exactly. leftist of the left. And so if they reject Chesa Boudin, it is about the national message and the national narrative. And this is going to help with a narrative that is being pushed by even in the Democratic Party, the conservative Democrats who want to claim that the reason why they're having a tough re-election is because of defund the police. And this is all part of that. And here's a rejection by the most liberal electorate in the country, the San Francisco right. liberals. And so I would imagine there's a ton more money too involved in this recall attempt, not just on the mechanics, but on the advertising that is also coming in, pouring in from national sources.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking about, almost $1 billion at this point. The Philadelphia election didn't even come close to that. That's on both sides. Yeah. It's insane. You think about sort of, and again, like I made this point earlier, but really thinking about the stated intentions of the folks behind the recall campaign, right? If crime is your biggest concern, if homelessness and addiction are your biggest concerns, is this really the best use of your money? Like, I think it's very obvious that the answer to that is no, especially because they don't have This is the other crazy part of this is that they don't have to articulate a vision for who will replace him or any sort of plan for what they want to build in his place. Right. So they basically get to spend all of this money saying, we want this person out. We want this person out. But when somebody has to make the decision of who will replace him or what the alternative system would look like, those aren't the people who have to answer that question.
So if he gets recalled,
right,
and is he out of office tomorrow? I mean, let's say the tally comes in tonight. Is he out of office tomorrow? And then there's got to be another election for who comes back in. And if that's the case, can he run again? I mean,
He can run again next year, technically. The mayor, London Breed, would. I think the Chronicle put out a piece sort of folks who might be, you know, the most likely people that she would select to as an interim replacement. But my understanding is that, and I might be wrong. So if I am, I admit that. but I believe that there would be an interim person selected to replace him. I don't know that he would be out tomorrow. I think there's a bit of a gap in the time, especially because I don't know if they'll have the results tonight. We're expecting right. them tonight. But yes, he would be eligible to run again next year.
All right. Well, people should go out and vote. And Akela, thank you so much for coming on. I want to say hi to your mom. Appreciate her tuning in today. That I'm glad to have her on board as well. Thank you so much. We're going to link to your piece, but people should go out and vote if you're in San Francisco. It's, you know, it's 10 o'clock in the morning out there. And so you got plenty of time. Appreciate your coming on today.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein I will take your phone calls and I will read your IMs. And I will play some videos that are fun. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. When you become a member, you not only allow this show to survive and thrive, but also you get the free half, free of commercials, and you have access to the fun half, which you can see on video or by audio. And we are posting the Boston show exclusively for members this weekend. So if you're a member, all you got to do, you'll get it in your feed, your podcast feed. If you want to watch the video, just go on to the Majority Report site at majority.fm. Should be at the, you know, one of the more recent posts, depending on when you get there. But you can always just search for Boston Show, and it will come up, and you will be able to watch it. Like I say, Senator Al Franken, Natalie Scherr, some great activists from Extinction Rebellion in Boston.
I wonder how that live music got recorded.
Live music from Ted Leo and the Combat Zone, and then this debate I had with a local right-wing host that, you know, sort of went sideways. So people can check that out. Remember, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. Try it out. You will not be disappointed. Matt, what's happening? Oh, and don't forget the AM Quickie, amquickie.com. Check it out. Go there. Sign up for it. Get it in your email box. Matt, what's up on the Matt Leckian Media Universe?
Yeah, for Left Reckoning patrons, this Sunday, David and I released a conversation with Brett Scott, who has a book called Cloud Money about the Wall Street and Silicon Valley conspiracy that's coming for cash and wants to move us all towards a cashless society that they can dominate. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to that conversation.
646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this with the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone? Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you?
No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go start life.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow.
Folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. You gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.